This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. This morning, the Maui County Council's Ethics and Transparency Committee has been taking up a proposed settlement involving the county's wastewater treatment facility in West Maui. A group of Maui-based environmental groups filed a lawsuit alleging the plant's discharge was violating the Clean Water Act. That lawsuit is still scheduled to be heard by the U.S. Supreme Court. We're going back to listen to the story that we aired back in February and then get an update on today's vote from HPR's Ryan Finnerty.
The Cuyahoga River in Ohio is so loaded with the waste products of petroleum distillation that it is actually in danger of catching fire.
In 1969, that's exactly what happened. The Cuyahoga River in Cleveland became so polluted that it burst into flames. This wasn't the first time Cleveland had seen a river fire, but the 1969 blaze fueled the budding national conservation movement. In 1972, Congress passed the Clean Water Act, overriding a veto by President Richard Nixon. It established water quality standards and created a structure for the federal government to regulate pollutants. The act bans dumping those pollutants directly into surface water sources, like rivers and lakes, but not groundwater. A court case from Hawaii may soon change that.
For years, it's been known that when the facility discharges from its injection wells into the groundwater directly beneath the facility, that millions of gallons of treated sewage get into the ocean each day.
That's David Henkin, an attorney with the environmental law firm Earth Justice. He's representing four Maui-based groups that are suing Maui County over the discharge from a wastewater treatment plant in Lahaina.
There have been massive algal outbreaks on the reef at Kahikili. There has been massive die-off of a once pristine reef, and this is largely due to the millions of gallons of treated sewage from the Lahaina facility.
The Lahaina Wastewater Reclamation Facility is located about 2 miles upslope of downtown Lahaina in West Maui. It first came online in 1975, and until the recent court ruling was not covered by the Clean Water Act. That's because the Clean Water Act only regulates discharge into surface water. The Lahaina facility injects treated wastewater back into the ground. Groundwater isn't covered by the Clean Water Act. But the situation changed in 2012.
Undebatable evidence that the wastewater was reaching from those wells to the coastline.
That's Craig Glenn, a geologist from the University of Hawaii at Manoa. The state of Hawaii and the EPA asked Glenn to determine whether or not the treated wastewater being injected into the ground was reaching the ocean.
The very first thing I did was run something that I personally specialize in, is using aerial infrared photography from aircraft to look for what we call submarine groundwater discharge. Fresh water, because it's colder than seawater when it leaks into the ocean, it appears as a cold water anomaly. And it's also, it floats on the surface of the seawater because it's fresh water, it's buoyant, and it floats on top of the seawater. We did the flights, and we found a very large thermal anomaly. And then we mixed tracer dyes and poured them down the injection wells that the wastewater treatment plant was using, and then nearly daily monitoring that took place for quite a long time. We even started before we did the injection dye, so we knew what the background was like, etc. These dyes are detectable in very small quantities, parts per billions, basically. And we started seeing the dye concentrations rise and rise and rise.
As surface water, the ocean is covered by the Clean Water Act. The proven connection between the wastewater plant and the ocean provided the basis for the current lawsuit. The Hawaii Wildlife Fund is the lead plaintiff in the case. Hannah Bernard is the director and co-founder of the Maui-based organization.
There had been suspicion that these waters getting into the reef wouldn't be good and might cause an impact.
A 2006 survey from the Hawaii Department of Land and Natural Resources deepened those suspicions. The survey found a roughly 25% decline in existing coral cover on West Maui reefs over a 12-year period.
People who are ocean users, we saw this study and we became alarmed. And we wanted to investigate and have more information about the possibility of, can we do something to mitigate this? And so we started organizing meetings and sharing the information and talking about it, and then we got in touch with our EPA. Actually, we organized public meetings with the EPA here several times.
The EPA was working with Maui County to address the impact of the injection wells when the groundwater dye study was published in 2012. That was when Bernard's group decided to sue, alleging a violation of the Clean Water Act. They initially won in federal court, and again when Maui County appealed the decision. The case will now head to the Supreme Court. Earth Justice Attorney David Henkin says there's a reason the court decided to take on the case.
The reason that the court is likely taking this case is that there is one court of appeals, which is the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, which decided a pair of cases out of Kentucky and Tennessee. And in those cases, that court of appeals said that the Clean Water Act does not require a permit if a discharge is via groundwater. In doing that, it directly disagreed with the decision in our case, which came out of the Ninth Circuit, which controls the western part of the United States, and the Fourth Circuit, which decided a case out of South Carolina. So basically, there's what's called a circuit split. The Ninth Circuit and the Fourth Circuit agree with us, and the Sixth Circuit agrees with the county. Only the Supreme Court, which makes decisions uniform national law across the country, only the Supreme Court can resolve the circuit split.
Maui County maintains that its practices at the Lahaina plant are safe. Here's County Communications Director Brian Perry reading a prepared statement.
Maui County welcomes the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to grant its petition for a hearing in its ongoing West Maui injection well case. We have a strong case to show that the county continues to protect the public's health and the environment through its use of facilities initially developed with EPA funding four decades ago and its robust recycled water program.
Maui County has challenged the idea that discharge from the Lahaina treatment plant is harming nearby oceans. In a published fact sheet, the county acknowledged the dye study but denied that discharge from the wastewater plant was responsible for algal blooms or coral death. The county also pointed out that previous court rulings did not address environmental damage. They instead issued the more narrow ruling that the Lahaina underground injection wells do require a Clean Water Act permit. The Hawaii Department of Health confirmed that the Lahaina wastewater facility does have an injection well permit on file and has also applied for a Clean Water Act permit. It did not confirm the status of that application or when it was submitted. I'm Ryan Finnerty for The Conversation.
And Ryan joins us live in the studio now. Ryan, you've been tracking that Maui meeting. What's the latest?
They are still deliberating, Catherine. Several members of the public came in to testify, several experts in either engineering or water recycling. A lot of questions from council members about some of the different facets of the case. So they're still deliberating. Probably we can expect a vote within the next hour or so. And that is, we should say, just a committee. So it's not the final say. If the committee votes in favor of this resolution that was put forth by Council Chair Kelly King, it would advance to the full council, which would make a final decision on the matter. And that's the Governance, Ethics, and Transparency Committee of the Maui County Council. And as we said, Kelly King, the full council chair, introduced that. And one of the reasons she said that she wanted to introduce this resolution was that she felt the makeup of the council had changed enough after the November election that it now has a more environmentally friendly, what she called progressive makeup. There were four open seats on that council in the November general election, and there was this sort of progressive wave, it was described as, taking over. And I spoke with Chair Kelly King ahead of today's hearing, and here's what she said.
Well, the resolution enacts a little-known ordinance which gives the purview to settle any case without the mayor's approval. And so it was a way for the council to just say, we don't have to wait for the settlement to be conveyed to us. We're just going to give ourselves the authority and move ahead with it. So we had a settlement that had been signed but never enacted because the county went ahead and appealed. And, you know, my desire to get this out of the court realm and into the realm of real solutions was to bring that settlement back. But in the meantime, Earth Justice came up with a new settlement offer and sent that to our corporate counsel. And it took about a week and a half for it actually to be conveyed to the council. We should have been given this settlement offer within a day or two, and it was basically withheld from the council.
Maui County Council Chair Kelly King there. And so she's basically, Catherine, frustrated with the lack of action. Under the laws of the county, it is the mayor's. He does have the authority to enter into a settlement. And the council kind of feels like there hasn't been any action, and they would like to see some action. So they've introduced this resolution that would basically enact a provision that Kelly King mentioned that allows them to unilaterally settle these kinds of cases. The details of that settlement were put together by David Henkin, who's an attorney for Earth Justice, the environmental law firm. He's representing the plaintiffs in this case, and I asked him to describe what's included in the settlement.
The settlement proposal also makes clear to the county, as long as the county is making good faith efforts to move towards reducing its reliance on the injection wells, both at Lahaina and elsewhere in the county, and is looking at ways to reuse that treated wastewater and put it to beneficial use, and ensuring that any continued use of these injection wells is going to protect the fragile marine environments into which the injection wells are discharging, that's all that we can reasonably expect the county to do. And so we have no interest in going back to federal court and seeking any type of civil penalties as long as the county is making reasonable, good faith efforts to move forward in that direction.
And I asked David what he considered a reasonable, good faith effort. He said that they had agreed with members of the county council on a down payment of $2.5 million towards reducing reliance on those injection wells. That money has already been included in the upcoming budget, so it's not seen as a major sticking point. You heard Kelly King say earlier that Maui County Mayor Mike Victorino has the power to end that and to agree to that settlement. It hasn't happened. Multiple people that I spoke with, though, indicated that he's not necessarily opposed to it. He's just sort of waiting to see what happens with the council, if they support it. It's worth noting that he won his first term in November, so he's still got a lot of political life ahead of him, and he probably doesn't want to be the sole person responsible for this decision either way. I asked the mayor's office for a statement. They gave me a written statement that said, "In this case, Maui County needs to clarify in how the Clean Water Act applies to permits for reclaimed wastewater for beneficial use. The County of Maui supports implementation of the federal law to protect the environment while not bankrupting taxpayers. For now, we reserve comment on the merits of the current settlement offer." Worth noting, Catherine, that the county does have a pretty substantial wastewater recycling program already. One of the designers of that system spoke at today's meeting and said that it's actually the most advanced in Hawaii, more even than Honolulu County. So they say this is already being done, that there's not uniform demand throughout the year because when there's less rain, people need more water from other sources. When there is rain, they don't need it. And so that just saying we're going to recycle all of this water is not necessarily an easy, practical solution.
And real quick, did Dave Henkin express any concern about whether this Supreme Court is environmentally friendly or not?
It did come up at today's meeting, actually. There were several concerns raised. Interestingly, some of the testifiers, one of whom is a lawyer, said he really thinks the county needs to pursue the case, that they can settle, do what's called a partial settlement, and address some of the specific issues raised by the local groups. But because, as we heard in the piece, there have been these types of appeals and split, the circuit split have happened in other jurisdictions within the United States, the Supreme Court selected this Maui case to settle this issue nationwide. And if Maui County withdraws it, it could be several years before the issue does get resolved finally for the whole country.
All right. Thanks a lot, Ryan.
Sure thing.
That was HPR's Ryan Finnerty with the latest on a potential settlement in a Clean Water Act lawsuit filed against Maui County. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Ulana, You may have noticed the scaffolding in front of the Liliuokalani Hale, the Judiciary Building, on King Street, as the King Kamehameha statue gets a much-needed facelift. For today's quiz, we are exploring the history behind the statue. In 1878, the Hawaiian legislature appropriated $10,000 for an American artist to sculpt and ship a statue of the king to Hawaii. Now, on the voyage from Italy, the ship burned and sank in the Falkland Islands, sending the royal statue to the watery depths. But luckily, it was insured. And soon enough, a replica by the same sculptor sailed to Hawaii and arrived safely in Honolulu. So for the question today, can you tell us who was the artist behind the iconic bronze sculpture that tourists flock to daily? And bonus points if you can tell us where that second statue of King Kamehameha is located. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Kona Choral Society, presenting A Musical Journey from Foray to Maori to Hawaiian, Sunday, May 26th, 4 p.m. at the Sheraton Keahoe Resort. Tickets at konachoralsociety.org.
Wind farms are a key part of the state's ambitious green energy goals. Four projects in operation are asking to amend their permits and raise the cap on how many native bats and birds it's allowed to kill as part of an incidental take. Just this month, Oahu's wind farm, Kawailoa Wind, announced plans to work with a new acoustic system aimed to reduce the casualties of endangered species. It comes as the public is being asked to weigh in on a draft environmental impact statement affecting four wind farms across the state. Michelle Bogardis is with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, the team manager for Maui and Hawaii Island. She lays out the changes to the draft conservation plan.
So the Fish and Wildlife Service is doing this environmental assessment to evaluate these four permit actions. We received four different permit applications from four different wind farms across the state of Hawaii, and they are seeking incidental take of endangered species. Our job is to evaluate and ensure that the plans that they've put together adequately avoid, minimize, and mitigate impacts to those endangered species.
Okay, and what are the species that we're talking about here?
We're talking about the Hawaiian hoary bat, Opeapea, the Hawaiian petrel, Uwa'u, and the Hawaiian goose, Nene.
And so when these applications first came in, they did get permits, correct?
Three of them did. So the one wind farm on Oahu and two of the wind farms on Maui had originally received incidental take permits around 6 years ago. But at the time, there was very little known about the presence of those endangered species within the area of the wind farm. And now we have updated information about the presence of those endangered species and the rate at which they are impacted.
So what can you tell us about that?
So in each case of those three wind farms, they have been doing a very high level of monitoring at and around their wind farm site under their existing incidental take permit and habitat conservation plan. Those plans worked. They recognized the fact that there was a higher rate of impact than what was anticipated, and because of that, they are now having to come back in and amend their take request.
So basically, we've had a higher kill rate than anyone anticipated.
That's correct.
And so how are you working through this process? We've got the meetings this week on various islands. Are you going to be focusing on each particular project as you go island from island?
A little bit. So last year, last June, we went around to all the different islands and held public meetings and asked the public for their input on what things we should be evaluating as we proceeded on this process. This time around, we're actually providing the public with our draft analysis for what this looks like for each of the four different wind farms and asking whether or not the public thinks that we adequately considered everything and did a good job on our analysis. So we, for each meeting, we're doing one on the island of Oahu on Tuesday, We're doing one on Maui on Wednesday, and we're doing one on Hawaii Island on Thursday. And in each case, we'll be talking to the public about the wind farms that occur on that island, as well as all four of them combined. So for Oahu, the wind farm is Kaualoa Wind Farm. They are on the North Shore. It's the one that's pretty close to Haleiwa Town. And they received a permit, I want to say in 2011, from us that addressed the take of all the endangered species that they thought they had the potential to take. At the time, we knew very little about Hawaiian hoary bats, Opeapea, on the island of Oahu. But over the last 5 years, we've learned a lot more. And they have been doing very rigorous monitoring on their site as a condition of their existing permit. In doing that monitoring, they found a higher rate of impact than what had been analyzed in their original permit, and so have been working with us for the last 3 years to put together a plan for how are they going to do that moving forward.
So what were the numbers on the original permit?
So the original amount for Kaualoa Wind Farm was 60 Hawaiian hoary bats, but they also had take of other endangered species as well. At this point, based on their current rate of take and the work that they've been doing, they are coming in and seeking an amendment to that permit to increase their take for Hawaiian hoary bats by an additional 205.
Oh, from 60 to 205.
We've heard a couple different concerns from the community, and part of that came from our scoping process last fall, as well as continued engagement with different communities across the islands. One of the concerns that we hear is whether or not this increase in take could result in impacts to the species at a population level. And another concern that we often hear is that bats Opeapea are considered to be amakua from some families. And so working through both of those issues and evaluating the impacts to them is part of what this process is designed to do. And we have done our best to analyze that in the draft NEPA document. At this point, we're asking the public to take a look at the analysis that we've put together and provide us any comments that they might have on how we put together that analysis and whether there's any additional information that we should be considering.
I guess if you're out and about, you know, maybe you'll see some hoary bats, but do we know enough about the species? I mean, I think 60 bats is a lot, but you know, more than 200. Do we know what the count is out in the wild?
Well, so interestingly enough, we don't have a lot of information about bat abundance for any species of bats across the country. Bats are cryptic by nature, and we have relatively archaic tools on how to actually monitor them. Mostly we use things that will tell us whether they're in the area, acoustic sound. We don't have a way of actually saying that there are X number of bats in any given place. But that's true for all bat species, particularly solitary bats like the Hawaiian hoary bat is. What we do know about the species, though, is that they are widely distributed. They're occurring on all of the main Hawaiian islands. They're breeding on all of the main Hawaiian islands. They seem to be very dispersed into all range of habitats. And overall, it seems like they're doing pretty well. Even though this level of take seems like a lot, it is actually only, you know, it varies by island, but somewhere between 5 and 11 bats per year per island. And so the question that we are evaluating in our NEPA documents is whether or not the population can withstand that level of impact and whether or not the plans that these wind farms have put together are adequately offsetting the impact that they are having.
There was an article in the newspaper here in Honolulu about something new that the wind farm was trying in order to reduce the take.
Correct. So for each one of these wind farms, they are required under this permitting process to avoid whatever take they can, minimize that take that cannot be avoided, and to offset whatever impact still remains. That's part of their requirements for them getting this permit. So if there is technology available out there to help them to either avoid or minimize the take from occurring in the first place, they are required to do that, and we work with them to ensure that they're using the best available science to make that happen. Deterrent technology is still being worked out on the mainland, and in some cases it's being really effective, in other cases it hasn't been as effective. It's not been tried in the Hawaiian Islands before, and we're not exactly sure what level of efficacy it will have for Hawaiian hori bats, but as soon as it is commercially available, most of the wind farms are going to be installing them, and we'll be testing to see how effective they are at avoiding the take in the first place.
Okay, and then what about the remaining wind farms?
Each wind farm has a slightly different plan, and the public can actually comment on those as well by looking through the PEIS and seeing their proposed actions. Each of those plans also is referred to as a habitat conservation plan, and it varies a little bit by wind farm. Each of the wind farms have the deterrents listed in there somewhere, but it's a question of how quickly they become commercially available and when they're installed.
Okay. And anything then specific to Maui that you'd want to underscore, you know, or the Big Island?
So for Maui, there's actually two different wind farms. One is KWP2, or Kaheawa Wind Power 2. That's the one that most people see when they're flying in on the airplane. And then Oahu is over on Leeward Haleakala side. Both of those wind farms have take of multiple endangered species, but we're having the public meeting, and for the people on Maui that would be interested, it's a single public meeting for both of those wind farms. So we'd encourage people to come out, and we'd love to share more about what's in this document with them and get their perspective on what we've included in our analysis.
Anything unique to Maui?
Nothing unique to Maui, other than what we already talked about for Oahu.
Are the numbers larger in the request, in the applications?
No. So for the Oahu wind farm, it is going from their original incidental take permit was 21 bats, and they are increasing that to, let's see, they're increasing that to 140. And KWP2, which is the Kaheawa Wind Power 2, their original take of bats was 11, and they are proposing to increase it to 38.
Okay. And then what about the remaining wind farm?
So the remaining wind farm is on the island of Hawaii, and that wind farm never has been operational, I want to say, for over 15 years. And they did not know at the time that the wind farm was built, it was a repowering. They did not know that there was any endangered species that could be impacted by their actions, and so they never applied for nor received an incidental take permit. But since that time, they have had a couple of incidents of Hawaiian hori bats in and around their wind farm, and because of that, we've been working with them on developing a plan now.
So were there no rules in place when they began operation?
There were rules in place, and we talked to them at that point, but there was no evidence that there was going to be endangered species that interacted with those turbines at that time. But because they have been doing monitoring, they did find that there were Hawaiian hori bats in the area, and so now they're coming in with a plan for how to avoid, minimize, and mitigate those impacts.
Okay, interesting. So some of this just, I guess we're trying to do the best we can based on the information that's available.
Correct.
Okay.
And that's true throughout all of our processes, is that we are using the best available information that we have available to us at the time. And especially when you're talking about Hawaiian hori bats, that information has been growing. And so what we knew 6 years ago is very different than what we know right now, and we're trying to ensure that our analysis takes into account all of that new information.
Okay. All right. And then we'll put in the information about the comment period, I guess, which runs till June 10th. Is that right?
June 10th.
Yeah.
I'm just double-checking with the comment period does go until June 10th. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Anything else that you think would be important to underscore just to try and get people out to these meetings?
It is very important that the public understands that for these four wind farms are already constructed and operational. We're not talking about the construction of any new wind farms. And we have gotten some questions already about whether or not these are new proposed wind farms in the islands. And no, this process is not for that. This process is to deal with the four that are already operational and their endangered species impacts.
That was Michelle Bogardis, team manager for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Office, talking to us from Maui. For the full schedule of this week's meetings and links to the proposed EIS, go to hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, dedicating this message of thanks to all the donors, volunteers, and staff who help to improve the health of those affected by kidney disease. KidneyHI.org.
Tragic story is the focus of our reality check this morning, featuring Honolulu Civil Beat reporter Brittany Lai. Good morning, Brittany.
Good morning, Catherine.
You know, set the scene for our listeners, as this really is a tale of two neighbors.
It is. It's a tale of sort of a great misunderstanding. And what happened a year ago in Ewa Beach is that a man whose name is John Hasselbrink, he's in the Navy, 41 years old, he's about to be deployed, and he goes out on a Saturday night, takes an Uber with a good friend, they have some drinks, they come home really late, almost 4 in the morning. The Uber drops this man, John, off at his neighbor's house instead of his own house in this row of townhouses where all of the units look the same. It's dark. He's had a few drinks. This man, John, is accustomed to leaving the door unlocked. He finds that his front door is locked, and he's trying to get in. He's pounding. He's rattling the knob. He's, you know, pushing his body against it. And what happens is he's at his neighbor's house. He doesn't realize this, and so the neighbor wakes up, and this event ends with a gunshot, and John's killed on the front porch in what really was a misunderstanding. The man inside who shot the gun thought that there was an intruder trying to break in and trying to protect his family.
So what was the latest development with this story?
So the latest development is that charges against the man, Gregory Farr, who shot the gun and killed Hasselbrink, have been dropped. So on Tuesday, tomorrow, a judge will decide whether or not the prosecution will be able to bring those charges back.
Now, the story really, though, has a just interesting twist because Hasselbrink's family kind of has been there before, right?
Yeah, so this is one of those interesting stories where it's a great misunderstanding, and I think it makes people think, what would I do if I were in that situation? If someone in the middle of the night were pounding on my door and they weren't stopping and I had a gun, would I shoot? Would I wait to see what happened? Would I answer the door? What would I do? And at the same time, I think people are trying to put themselves in the shoes of the man who's just trying to go home and making a mistake at the wrong door. So that's something that the family of John Hasselbrink has asked themselves, and they have, in a way, been in this situation before. When John and his sister, Pamela Kellerman, who I spoke with, were kids, Pamela tells me there's this memory of in the middle of the night, they get woken up, they're in their parents' house in California, they're young, there's pounding on the door, and their father goes and answers the door. And finds that the person who's banging on the door in the middle of the night is drunk, had a few too many drinks, and, you know, is at the wrong door. So really the same scenario. And she's kind of used this memory that she has to kind of justify the way she looks at this situation, that the person who shot her brother, he did have another choice. He could have, you know, tried to suss out the situation before shooting.
It's just so tragic. Do you think the Hasselbrink family will just keep pursuing this?
I know that they would like the charges to be reinstated. State prosecutors haven't said whether or not they will refile the charges if they're allowed to, but I think we'll know a lot more tomorrow when a judge makes some decisions. That's what's expected about whether or not the charges can go forward or whether they'll stay dropped as they are right now.
And is that a court hearing in the morning?
It's in the afternoon.
In the afternoon, okay. All right. Well, we'll be looking for an update there with Honolulu
yes.
Civil Beat. But thanks for tracking this for us. We appreciate it. Important story.
Yeah. Thank you.
That was reporter Brittany Light with today's reality check. If you haven't yet read her story, visit civilbeat.org.
My name is Chris Friend-Rice. I'm the Director of Operations for Veterinary Emergency and Referral Center of Hawaii. Our favorite thing about being an underwriter for HPR is definitely the feeling that we are giving back to the community. In general, that's something that our business tries to do on a regular basis. Hawaii Public Radio, being something that we all listen to personally, was a natural choice for us to support that and give back.
Hawaii Public Radio Underwriting, your message heard here.
This is The Conversation on listener-supported Hawaii Public Radio. We now check in with astronomer Christopher Phillips and HPR's Dave Lawrence with your Monday Stargazer.
Stargazer time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our tiny planet. Also, a report on things we can try and spot in our dark skies. As usual, we're turning to the expertise of Christopher Phillips, and we've got him on the line right now. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do we have this week?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be here. So this week, stargazers look out for Mars in the west and Jupiter in the eastern sky. Both planets are bright and easy to spot. The moon will begin to wane this week, which of course means darker skies towards week's end.
And I understand there's some local hydroponic work that is destined for space.
Indeed. Students at UH Manoa have been conducting research on sustainable, safe, contained, and autonomous hydroponic systems. These systems may one day allow astronauts and colonists to grow their own food as well as medicinal plants and oxygen-producing favorites.
How interesting. And what's the testing process for something like that?
Well, the Box Farm, as it is known, has been sent to NASA's Inflatable Lunar and Mars Habitat at the University of North Dakota. In fact, testing will be wrapping up later this week.
And there's probably uses for this technology here on Earth, I'm imagining, as well.
Absolutely. And one of the great things about this technology is that it can be scaled up to grow hundreds and possibly thousands of plants. That's incredibly important for sustainable agriculture here on Earth.
And I guess you're thinking places that have limited growing space or resources here on Earth could really benefit from it.
Absolutely, they will benefit. And in this day and age, developing sustainable agriculture is critical to our health and the health of the planet. And it's awesome to see space technology being used to solve problems here on the Earth.
And again, Christopher, this is being done by who now locally?
And this is engineering students at UH Manoa.
And they've created this technology, and it's sort of like in a box, and then it got shipped off to North Dakota. Is that what basically happened?
Yep, it's completely self-sustained, which means you can basically pack it into a shipping container and send it anywhere in the world if you really had to.
And they're testing it there because they've got conditions that sort of replicate what might be expected if this was being used in space?
Yeah, the Lunar Mars Habitat is perfectly suited to testing these types of missions that simulate missions off-world.
Another fascinating report. Christopher Phillips, thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week. And we keep Stargazer at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for Stargazer comes from Haleakala Ranch, with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to create, maintain, and preserve open spaces for the Maui community. More at HaleakalaRanch.com.
stay tuned, because I'll be talking with a couple of conservationists about the restoration work taking place on the golden statue of King Kamehameha in Honolulu. But did you know the interesting story behind its creation? The Honolulu statue was not the original one. The original was assumed lost after the ship carrying it from Italy burned and sank in the Falkland Islands. Luckily, the $10,000 statue was insured. A replica, created by the same sculptor, arrived in Honolulu in 1883 and installed across from Iolani Palace. As the story goes, a British ship showed up shortly after in Honolulu Harbor with the originally commissioned statue. It had been salvaged and purchased by the ship's captain for $500. The captain offered it to Kalakaua for $1,500, but because it was missing a hand and a spear, the captain let it go for $875. That statue can now be seen in front of the Kohala Public Library on the Big Island, the birthplace of Kamehameha the Great. And the artist who crafted both images, his name was Thomas Gould, a Boston sculptor living abroad in Florence, Italy. Congratulations to our winner, Lynn from IAEA. You got it right. And we should mention that my co-host, Chris Vandercook, called to say, another Chris called in to say that there are actually four statues of the king. There was one that was installed in the 1990s in Hilo on the Big Island, and the fourth is in Washington, D.C. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Driving through downtown Honolulu, you may have noticed scaffolding around the statue of King Kamehameha fronting the Judiciary Building. It's a project funded by the Hawaii State Foundation of Culture and the Arts. Visitors on a tour of downtown couldn't get a good view for their photos, and passerbyers wondered what was going on. Here's Boston's John Ballinger.
Yes, it's one of the stops on the tour we paid for, yeah. And now it's wrapped in plastic.
A little disappointed?
A little bit, yeah. We can see just the top of his head. And that makes it seem like we should want to see more.
Now, the statue of the king was commissioned back in the 1800s and made in Florence, Italy, but the wax and the patina was worn, and that's why conservators with RLA, a California-based company, were hired to restore the bronze statue. We talked to David Espinoza and Christina Varvey with the company RLA Conservation, Inc. about the work that's underway.
This is part of a large contract that you've got with the state. Tell us about what's going on.
It is. So the State Foundation put out a nationwide solicitation for art conservation services. We submitted our proposal in the fall of last year and were awarded the contract. And so since March, we have been doing various projects around the islands. We started here in Oahu. We did a training for local technicians so that when we complete all of these projects, local residents will be able to maintain the works after we're gone. Long-term. And so we did a bunch of projects here, and then in April we were in Hawaii for 2 weeks. Now we're back here for three, doing a couple more, and then we'll also move on to Maui in July.
Okay, so tell us what's involved in restoring the King Kamehameha statue. What have you had to do?
Well, during our first trip in March, my colleague and I, we came over and we took a look at him, and we match the gold color to the existing, so we didn't want to just arbitrarily pick a color gold. So we had some samples and we were looking at the different shades and what would be the best match to integrate new gold with existing where it could be salvaged. So that was the first step. And then coming here, we worked on the bronze elements first. My colleague David submitted a range of samples of different patina colors to the foundation for their approval prior to us starting. So we worked on all of the visible brown bronze shades first, because we have to use heat and certain chemicals to achieve those colors and then put a protective wax coating on them. So we needed to get all of that done before we started to do the gilding. And then there was surface preparation ahead of that as well.
What kind of shape would you say the statue was in?
Bronze is very resilient. It's a really harsh environment. He is in full sun throughout the day. It's also an urban environment. You have all the cars and the airports nearby, and we're not far from the water, so there's ambient salts in the air. It's very moist, so that does take a toll on it, but he actually wasn't that bad for, you know, we don't really know the last time that this process was done. And there are still a lot of traces of gold. Areas that were deteriorated were in places you would expect them to be, those on the top and the horizontal surfaces that get beaten down the most by the sun and the elements.
The fact that we didn't have to do any bronze repairs is really remarkable, because it's an old sculpture. And so it's in remarkable shape in terms of the integrity of the bronze itself. We start with a general washing, just getting all the bird droppings, grime off of them, and then we further assess the condition after that so we can more clearly see everything. Then we went through a process of removing any residual coatings, and like Christina said, we started with the bronze since that's a very chemically and heat intense process. We used propane torches to heat up the bronze and do certain chemical reactions that changes color a bit. So once we got that process out of the way, got his skin tone to a place where we liked it and the state approved it, we moved on to the gold. And that's a process using different primers and special adhesives for gilding. And that's what we've been working on for the past few days.
Okay. You're the same company that worked on the King Kamehameha statue on the Big Island. So talk about that.
Yeah, so that sculpture had last been repainted by a colleague of ours. His name is Glenn Wharton, and he was a conservator with the Museum of Modern Art in New York, and he wrote a book about his experience and process repainting it called The Painted King. And he spent, I believe, over a year with the community researching colors and whether or not it should be repainted or taken back to bronze and gildings like the one here in Honolulu. So that was the last time that one had been worked on. So it was over
20 years.
Yeah, it was over 20 years since it had been repainted. So we were contacted by the community at a local conservator's recommendation in 2016. So we went out there and looked at the sculpture, did an assessment, gave them a proposal, and then they had to do some fundraising. And it wasn't until this past summer that we went out as a team. You know, matching the same exact colors. They had samples of the original paint colors that the community had selected and approved. They kept them out of the sunlight, so they were well protected and still the original colors. So we had all of that information available to us. And we actually also worked with a local technician there from that community in Javi to strip the old failed coatings, prep the surface, and repaint him according to, you know, what they had known and also agreed upon in terms of the colors.
Right, and I believe the story goes that when the statue was headed over here, that statue actually was supposed to be here, and that it sunk on a ship and was lost. So then this second bronze statue was commissioned and then put in place, and then they found the other one.
This is the insurance policy. Once it was lost at sea, they were able to cast a new one pretty quick, and so that's why Javi got the original after they discovered it.
Yeah, it's a fun little story, really.
It's a great story, and it was really remarkable to work on, and especially for this team, because this is the exact same team that did the one in Javi. So we've both, all three of us, Christine and our technician Nelson, have had the opportunity to work on both of the kings.
Familiar face,
yeah.
And so tell us, so all this work is being done in advance of King Kamehameha Day, so it really is going to be a real treat when folks come out here to pay homage to the king.
Yeah, I hope that they'll love him. I think he's cleaning up very nicely. And one thing that I'm really proud of is the patina that we got on him. One of the key suggestions we got from the residents on the Big Island is that the king in Hilo he doesn't look Hawaiian, his skin tone. So I think we were able to make him look more like a local. I think the populace will like that.
How difficult has it been trying to restore a statue? I mean, you folks have basically got a week, right?
Yeah, we have, but we took that into consideration when we submitted our proposal to the State Foundation. There's always environmental challenges working outdoors.
It's a bit windy today.
It's a tad windy, yeah, so we've set up some tarps and things like that to help kind of protect us a little bit. You know, there's been rain showers and sprinkles like that, but we're used to this. It happens all the time. So we just kind of have contingency plans and kind of roll with the punches. We can move on to other things if you know, some other element kicks up, so we're used to it.
And then after this, then you'll come back later this summer to work in Maui? Talk about that.
Yeah, we'll be going to Maui in July and working on two large bronze artworks there. And one is in the airport, and the other one is at the University of Hawaii at Maui. And it'll be 3 weeks out there because those bronzes have a lot of actual physical repairs that need to be done versus this, which is more of a finish treatment. So
what is the one over at the airport?
Sun God, large bronze, and he's holding up a gilded sun. And it's right when you're checking in your bags to get on the plane. So it'll be fun because we'll be right in the, like, a big fishbowl for everyone to look at.
Okay, well, they just completed their car rental facility, so it's going to look very different from when maybe you folks were there last.
Okay, all right.
They've modernized the airport.
That's good.
Anything else you want to add just about the work that you're doing? Because you'll be coming back to do some of the other bronzes.
Yes, exactly. I don't know. It's just everybody's been extremely supportive, passersby, not just tourists, but people who live and work in the area, and not just with this sculpture. Even the last trip we were here, we worked on Queen Liliuokalani over by the State House and her palace, and just people very kind and supportive and appreciative that, you know, the state is taking care of these artworks and that we'll have a maintenance plan in place moving forward to keep them at a, you know, a certain level, and it's just really lovely to work here.
When we were out with the team last week, all that had to be done were the final touches on the gold leaf and a proper polishing. The scaffolding that had been hiding the bronze statue was expected to come down today or tomorrow. The king will be ready for prime time as the holiday in his honor, King Kamehameha Day, on June 11th, is just around the corner. The King Kamehameha Celebration Commission is planning the lei draping and parade here in Honolulu starting on June 7th. Other celebrations are also being marked across the state.
Hi, this is DJ Mr. Nick, host of Bridging the Gap. We're teaming up with the Hawaii State Library to take the show out of the studio and into the library. My co-host and I will be taping the show live on May 28th through the 31st from 12 to 2 p.m. at the Hawaii State Library in downtown Honolulu. We'll be pulling music exclusively from their collection and then reshelving it for you to borrow the next day. More information at hawaiipublicradio.org.
We have to go, but up tomorrow, we wind up our focus on the Big Island, on the long road to recovery following last year's natural disasters. And we plan to sit down and have a conversation with Governor David Ige. We'd like to hear from you. Call our talkback line. Leave your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of The Conversation.